Up next on the G&M Family Market phone line, one of our favorite guests, I think the smartest guy working a keyboard anywhere in the country these days, soon to be plying his trade for the great people at Deadspin, David Roth joining us this afternoon. David, how are you?
I'm good, Rich. How are you doing?
Fantastic, thank you. Look, let's get right to the really important stuff, because you and I were going back and forth on social media last night. How eerie is it that Tom Price bears a striking resemblance to Tim Gunn?
Yeah, this is a good sports talk, what the listeners crave. It's extremely eerie because, to me, Tim Gunn is something like the personification of all that is good in American life. And Tom Price, I think of as sort of being like not totally the working opposite, but like a good substitute in a pinch.
I also think that Tim Gunn, if given the opportunity, would have no hesitation about flying commercial.
Oh my gosh, yeah. I mean, he's a beyond. I mean, it's hard to say that someone's a man of, man of the people when he wears a suit probably to bed. But at the same time, yeah, I don't have a hard time imagining him deigning to take the Amtrak from D.C. to Philadelphia, for instance.
And you had a brief street encounter with him in New York?
I did. I am used to seeing not like famous people on the street, but like all New Yorkers, you try to sort of play cool in situations like that. My wife loves Project Runway very much. It's gone from being a show that I would not be in the room while she was watching to one that I sit on the couch next to her when she watches and kind of watch myself, which is like a massive step up show-wise. But I was surprised at how starstruck I was seeing the dude on the street, not just because it was a blazing hot day in July and he was indeed wearing like a completely dapper tailored suit walking down the street. But he's one of the people that I would willingly make myself dorky in front of to express my admiration, but I did not in this case because he was talking to a friend.
Well,
so my wife and I just kind of walked past him and then high-fived on the other side of it.
My evolution is pretty much the same as yours. I started just sort of sitting there while my wife watched, but I got pulled in. And part of it is because he seems like on that show to be maybe the most compassionate human being on the earth.
Yeah, it's such a, I mean, especially in reality television where, so many of the iconic characters are the opposite of that. Like, that really is, I think, the thing that sets the show apart. I mean, especially in the world of competitive reality, like, that's the only mentor role that you really see and stuff like that. And he seems to come by it honestly. Like, he really seems to care about helping these young designers improve. Somehow he cares about it enough that now I care about it too, which is weird.
Exactly.
That I wouldn't have guessed.
Now, the last time we talked with you, you were still working with the folks at Vice Sports. It's been an interesting writing odyssey since then in this ever-changing business. Can you tell the story of what happened there and what's coming up in the near future for you? That's very exciting.
Yeah. Broadly speaking, there was a pivot to video, as they say, and Vice Sports was scaled back and folded into the broader Vice.com. Some of my friends are still working there. And anyway, I got a decent severance package and the opportunity to freelance for a bit while I thought about what I wanted to do next. And, for a while I was pretty sure that whatever I would do next would just like that it would start with not involving the internet and that going from there, it would just be pretty much anything would be fine. But I enjoyed doing the writing that I was doing and I enjoyed freelancing as long as there's the sort of the safety net of, knowing that you don't have to wait for all those checks to arrive because it can be a long time. And I was lucky enough to catch on with Deadspin, and I'll be starting with them in October, which I'm very excited about.
Well, that's very exciting for everybody out there, I think. Now, can you explain this to us, and we'll tie it into sports a little bit here finally. Can you explain how writing about Ben McAdoo's sideline fashion has had a great impact on, your social media life?
Yes. This is a good question. That was something that I did at Vice last year because I've always been struck by how weirdly Ben McAdoo dresses. Like, even by the standards of NFL football coaches who are required by league rules to just basically wear pajamas at all times on the sidelines, he dresses like he weighs 150 pounds more than he does. He wears these huge, billowing, short-sleeved windbreakers and, like, tactical shades, like weird kind of, it's all sort of, the writer Mina Kimes pointed out that he always sort of looks like he's wearing a disguise. And I've never seen a better description of him than that. So that is the sort of the working way that I would explain him to people. But I wrote a piece that was just a little blog post that was about, you know, how you can get the Ben McAdoo look. You know, I shopped on the NFL team store to find the khakis and the pullover and the sunglasses that he had. And I wrote a little post explaining to people that wanted to wear a disguise at themselves as Ben McAdoo wearing a disguise. If they wanted to do it, these would be the clothes they could use. And then those ads, because of the way that the internet works, because I had visited this shopping page, whoever, Google, whatever it is that scrapes that information, was extremely sure that I was very close to purchasing those windbreakers. And so it would show me ads everywhere I went throughout the internet, on Facebook, on any other website, which is kind of amusing and then also kind of insulting. Not just that they think that I wouldn't have the courage to buy that windbreaker if I really wanted it, but also just to be reminded in every moment of how subservient my life is to Ben McAdoo's windbreakers as a writer.
We're talking with David Roth here on Downtown. Now, NBA season is not too far away. I know you're a big basketball guy. What's the most compelling story to you in this coming season?
Well, it's going to sound like pandering to your listeners, but it authentically is the Celtics to me, just because I have no idea how that team is going to work. I think it will work. It has really good players, and that's usually a good start. You know, beyond knowing the fact that it seems like, again, we're probably likely to get, you know, Warriors and Cavaliers come summertime, the process of getting there, I hope, will be more interesting than it was last year. There was something kind of beyond the preordained element. It, you know, everybody knew that those finals were coming. I was looking forward to them all year, but the playoffs were kind of lame, and it was clear that some teams would need to improve for that to be avoided, and the Rockets got better, I think, in a way that I can sort of imagine how that's going to work. But plugging the pieces that the Celtics got into Brad Stevens' system is, I'm having a harder time imagining it, but every, you know, the flashes of realization that I can see in my head are pretty awesome. So I'm interested in seeing how that all fits. Stevens is a terrific coach, and I have no doubt he'll be able to make it work. It's just, to stay on the Tim Gunn theme, but I have no idea how exactly Kyrie Irving and Gordon Hayward can be plugged into the offense they were running last year.
Yeah, we're a little curious to see that up here as well, but yeah, it's going to be fun. All right, you've brought up a very important point on social media. I think it's a great bit of sociological experimentation and thought here, and that's the notion that most of what we see on the internet, particularly social media, is old people complaining about what they see on TV.
I think that's true, and I want to say that I am. I should have had a sort of a follow-up tweet on that, pointing out that young people complaining about old people would also be a sizable percentage, I think, of what we see in the discourse. As somebody who's not quite young or old, I am, of course, exempt from any criticism. But in that case, I think that I had the thought, there was an image that was getting passed around of Ben Stein, who people maybe remember as the guy, the Bueller guy from Ferris Bueller's Day Off, the movie that came out in 1986.
Yeah, former Nixon speechwriter, too.
Yes, former Nixon speechwriter, former co-game show host with Jimmy Kimmel. I mean, he's had an interesting life. It's just also why he was on Fox News complaining about Beyonce's mention of climate change during the Houston telethon. Now, I hate what I just said, and I'm sorry that your listeners had to hear it, but think about what that is. Like, why? What essential perspective is that? And then also, like, even if he was upset about it, like, you're that upset about it? Like, just, you can, there's other channels, man. Like, there's also books. Like, you know, he can read. He wrote speeches. So it does sort of, I don't know, that crystallized for me in a way this sense of kind of aimless, absent complaint that seems to have kind of taken over the discourse in the Trump era. It's like, in a very real way, we're all sort of living in his Twitter timeline. And it's kind of unpleasant.
Yeah, no question about that. So I feel badly. I saw this on your Twitter feed. I have to confess, I didn't know until I saw this that there had ever been a climate change horror movie.
Oh, yeah, this is my favorite of the freelance things that I've done, mostly because of the fact that I you know, it's an essay about a horror movie that very few people ever saw. So it's a miracle that I got to write it in the first place. I thank Scott Tobias and Oscilloscope Labs for letting me. The movie is called The Last Winter, and it was made in 2006, came out in 2007. And it is about, it's like sort of like the thing, except for instead of there being a thing, it's sour gas from the melting Arctic permafrost having some negative effects on people, we'll say, at an oil exploration sort of site. And it's a good movie, very low-key, independent horror movie that basically no one saw. It made less than $100,000 worldwide. And it is, as far as I know, the only scary movie that's been made about the single scariest thing about contemporary life. So I rewatched it and tried to figure out how that could be. And the conclusion that I came to give away the essay a little bit, is that I think that global warming is kind of too scary to make a scary movie about.
Mm.
You sort of need a monster you can beat,
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Even if it's with, you know, some incantation or like a, you know, lucky amulet. And this sort of doesn't work that way.
Yeah, so you made your annual pilgrimage up here to Maine. Did you have a fun visit?
It was fantastic. I was so happy to do it and so sad to come back. But it was very nice. I hope that my in-laws are able to listen this time around. The previous time I was on, my father-in-law was in Blue Hill buying something, and apparently the station doesn't come in as well there, but they are in Stonington now, presumably rapt and delighted to be hearing my voice. It was terrific, and I can't wait to get back. We'll be back around Christmas time, which we do to spend time with my wife's family and all that. But yeah, I've been thinking about it a lot since I came back.
Excellent. Well, we're so excited for this new opportunity for you and the readers at Deadspin who are going to love it. David, always great having you on the show. Thanks, as always, for visiting with us.
Thank you very much, and thanks for your support. I appreciate it a lot.
David Roth, follow him on Twitter. He's the best out there, and soon writing for Deadspin.